You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM, K296 FT West Haven serving Portland at 107.1 FM, and K219KU Nehalem serving the Oregon coast at 91.7 FM. Streaming live and archived at xray.fm. Radio is yours.
Use a hand. Oh, I wish that I could write it like Townes Van. to hear your voice from a pretty painting of paradise. I'll say your name through the frame. You may meet.
Fourth grade, I memorized James Weldon Johnson's The Creation for the oratory competition. And I thought, oh, I can say that. I didn't think I could write that, but I definitely got on stage and said that thing. But then at 2021, Leave It to Love Jones and Sister Sonia Sanchez's poem ringing out at the end, and the beginning. And I was like, no, I want to do that. I want to do that now. And it took me a year from seeing that film to when I was dared to write a poem and perform it at an open mic, before I realized like that was where I wanted to like, you know, spend a lot of my time. I've always been a writer, very much in love with writing in all genres. So much so now, even though I consider myself a poet, I recognize that I use poetry as the nucleus for all the ways in which I, you know, investigate the genres. And that has a lot to do with my love for reading as a young person. Yeah. How about you?
I was a performer before I was a reader. And when I think about how I found my way to poetry, or when I uncovered a poet that first was like, oh, I could see myself in that, it was through the experience of listening or memorizing scenes from plays in sixth and seventh grade, right? It was the experience of feeling and seeing my own body in motion and embodying language that made me excited about that possibility for myself. It's what made me fall in love with language. I grew up in a family where everybody was really avid readers, and I struggled as a reader, and I have vivid memories as a little kid when it was like reading time in my house. Everybody would read, and I remember just looking at the book and pretending to turn the page, because like that's what people did when they were quote unquote reading. And I don't know, I will never forget that. And it stands out because I love reading now. But the thing that allowed me to be excited about it was music, and it was drama, and it was ways of finding myself in the auditory experience of reading and language that felt more like the literacy that I needed and wanted at the time I was learning to read texts and books. And I still feel that way. There is a deep musicality to much of my poetry, my poems, much of the work that I fell in love with, and the community of poets that I created around myself in New York as a young 20-something person honors that musicality of language, you know. It's always necessary to name that I had a high school English teacher, right? His name was Jeff Cass. Yay. And he, for a living, his entire job was dedicated to convincing people that they could be poets. And he convinced me. He was like, you don't have to walk around writing poems, but you do need to build a muscle for noticing the world around you. And when you do notice something, what does it mean to write it down? Mm-hmm. Just a bullet, just a thought. You might come back to it on a rainy day when you're not sure what you want to do with yourself, but there's that bullet. He's like, if I do my job right, I will start to offer lenses so that you can move through the world with a heightened sense of noticing each other and yourself. And I was like, I'm in. Turn it up.
So both of you are major figures in performance poetry world, and you've collaborated many times. To capture the origin of that connection, Mahogany, what was the first memory of hearing Adam's poem on the page or on the stage?
What was it? It was New Eureka Poets Cafe, sure, in which I hosted, curated, and led the poetry direction for about 14 years. And Adam had won a slam on Wednesday night, securing his role, his place in Friday night slam, and that's when I first saw his work. Several things happened. One, he does not look like what he's about to do. Right? You don't. You like, he gets up there and he's giving Boy Scouts, honey. Like, he's knocking on the door selling candy bars. Like, truly the sweetest. And you're like, okay, he's going to do something very Jack Kerouac, you know? It's going to be, okay, it's going to be fine. And he got up there with the same rhythm and soul that he speaks of as a performer, who has been invested in hip hop, not just lurking, right? He spoke with the same rhythmic insistence as someone who learned the blues and gospel, who got it right in the learning, who studied it and was aware of his position in the world. So he never like got up on stage and told the line with, I'm cool because I know black culture, right? He was always, you know, this young man from Michigan, okay. Because I messed up sometimes. but he was just like this young white guy from Michigan that had an affinity for hip hop, that had a respect of the people around him, that didn't look down at them. Because, you know, he may benefit from these privileges. He actually walked in with a studious effort of being an accomplice. And I noticed it. Like, it's a rarity when you see it, but when you do, you know, like, okay, I can be safe here. And I listened to the poem that he performed that day, and I was like, this is not real. And then he started singing, and it was like church, truly, gospel. And I thought, no way. No. And then the third round, he did it again. And I was like, okay, that's it. That's, we need to know who he is. That's it. Yeah, you was a cool lad.
A cool lad?
The New Eureka Poets Cafe is the most famous poetry slam in the world. And Mahogany L. Brown is the longest Friday night host that that venue has ever seen. And I knew of both Mahogany and the New Eureka Poets Cafe before I even graduated from college and came out to New York. Mm-hmm. You know, part of my trajectory toward being excited about work that merged music, drama, and like hyper attentive lyric was through the New Eureka Poets Cafe.
Adam, what was the first poem or performance of Mahogany's that truly stopped you in your tracks?
Oof. It had to be Single Mother Song. And the funny thing about Mahogany's work is that you can experience it in so many different ways because Mo's work is so prolific and visible. Right, you can read it in anthologies and in journals. You can see it on screen. At the time, you could see her work on HBO. That I knew who she was. But it wasn't until I showed up nervous with some desire to present my own work, but really just wanted to show up and be in a space that, frankly, was closer to church to me than church. I just needed to learn more about where I was at. It wasn't until I was able to like watch her perform and experience the impact that her work had on a room like that, that took my breath away. I remember competing in the slam, and in between the rounds, probably round 2 and 3 or something like that, you gave the judges a chance to tally up their scores, and you gave us a poem, and that poem was Single Mother Song. And I completely forgot that I was in the slam. I remember I cried, and it was just the presence that you brought into that room. And the New Eurekan is a rotating crowd. You have your regulars, but it's a famous enough venue that like half the room is there because Time Out New York said go there, which means those are maybe poetry fans, but they're also very likely people who have never been to a poetry event and this is their one. So to know that she could that immediately and that quickly open up a room with a poem that was at once both bold and brave and very tender and very emotional. It just blew me away. It blew the hinges off of what I thought was possible and what I wanted to do in New York City. That's a person. That's a person that I want to be near in some way.
How do you navigate the tension between writing and trauma and preserving your own well-being?
Yeah. Mm.
Go.
Say it again so they can hear you in the back.
You don't.
Just kidding.
Something that I used to make a part of the core tenets of poetry performance, which included 8 weeks of like writing performance boot camp. One of the major tenets was, it is okay to write the hard thing. You don't have to perform it, right? Because more times than not, we witness folks writing. Some true, some not. Some true, some not stories. And in turn, you have a lot of people who were trying on suffering for a slam score or making themselves cry for a slam score and really triggering other people because they actually had that experience, right? People were finding themselves, their voice, using the New Eurekan stage and many other stages of performance poetry as sources of healing, when in fact, we've learned that, yes, you can say the hard thing and someone can, like, you know, awaken this desire to, like, figure out what that needling was within them. Maybe they get therapy. Maybe they find a new self-care situation. But just writing the hard poem and then reading it and crying through it and then crumbling later does not make a good poem for me. And I had to like learn that the hard way after witnessing these young poets bear their all on stage and there be no social workers nearby, and we find out that they are untherapized and unmedicated. And then it became a real, like, I don't know, like, I won't say my ministry, but I was a stickler for, I'm not willing to put you in harm's way for the poem to be good, for us to get a 10. I would rather you write the thing and leave it in your journal so you can take that thing to your therapist, and then we write a group poem about joy. Or we write about, you know, how to burn down the system, but not just you reliving this violent trauma and crawling out of the well of yourself for a slam score.
I co-sign 100% on all that you've shared. I think I am probably a poet who did come up in the era of write toward your pain, right? Writing should risk something. Writing should feel dangerous. There should be an aspect of vulnerability and scariness for the writer. And I still cherish that way of thinking about writing. Given the context Mahogany just shared, I think what that actually means for me has evolved tremendously over the course of my life, right? Especially as a teacher, too, who did practice every kid has a journal and you write in it like it's your diary every day. And if there are things that, like, you bring up that need to go down to the social worker, cool, we unearthed it, let's go do that, talk to them, right? It was a way of unearthing and naming where pain and trauma lived so that we could manage it or handle it in the context of a school community. Personally, I thought for a very long time that the darkest and hardest stories about who I was were the ones that held the most currency, right? Like, the parts of me that felt broken and most in need of healing were the ones that I needed to write about first before I could have the license to then go explore other topics. I don't believe that's true anymore. I do think those are stories that people should tell, people should wrestle with, and I do think writing is a deeply, clinically proven tool to help us work through where our pain lives and where our trauma lives. And it is one of a litany of places where I think writing and the process of thinking in language, you know, can be healing.
Talking about reinventing yourself as an artist, how many times have you intentionally reinvented your work or our identity?
Honestly, I would say twice. And maybe not re-identified myself, but expanded my identity. I started off as a poet who was on HBO's Real Sex alongside these the Punani poets who were writing poetry for a specific group, the hip-hop centered group, with a desire to talk about sex, safer sex methods, in like this space where people didn't want to wear condoms and Eazy-E had just died. So we were like using erotica to promote safer sex methods. And that's what my introduction to the poetry world as, oh, I'm doing this for real, was. I thought even when I was doing erotica, I was doing it as a joke. I was making fun of erotic poets because I thought they were corny. Including, you know, some of my castmates. I was just like, you know, I was trying to be like this, I don't know, jester about it. And realized, you know, years later that, no, it was really groundbreaking work. And I didn't want to only be known for, you know, this poem that was in this one specific adult space. Fast forward, I'm still writing about, you know, killing misogyny and absolutely inspired by bell hooks and June Jordan and Audre Lorde, where black feminism and black rage are all righteous, until I guess within the last 10 years. And that's been like the trajectory of my work since 2002, I would say. That has been like my focus. And then 2013, I wrote a kid's poem, like just for kids, like on purpose. And while I had been teaching in schools alongside the likes of Adam Faulkner, I just was teaching them poems that I read because down with the machine, baby, like, let's go, everybody, like, get to work, right? And then I just like oscillated my view a little, and someone said, would you write this poem for kids? And I was like, oh, okay, I'll try. I'll try not to curse. And turns out I'm kind of good at that shit. But me not cursing for children's books and children's poems, I guess, is my third identity.
So I often had the experience as a young person, which is like a pretty universal queer idea, of just sort of gently costuming as best I can to fit in here. But it's really important to me that my varsity athlete friends know that I do not do musical theater, right? And I think I spent a lot of my life trying to keep these separate selves quarantined for fear of what might happen when they collide. What happens when they collide is that we're actually, heaven forbid, we're seen or we're known. So I think the process of my own reinvention or continuing to invent myself as an artist is actually less trying on new things and more creating new conditions in my life, whether that's friendships or new books or projects that I'm working on that allow the various selves that I have historically kept quarantined in their own separate silo to tilt, so that each time I am striving to build something in the world or in a relationship with someone, I'm trying to give all of myself permission to collide.
Listening to Street Roots Radio on X-Ray FM. I'm Hannah Francis. Street Roots Radio is a collaboration between X-Ray FM, KBOO Radio, and local publication Street Roots. Street Roots is a nonprofit organization in Portland, Oregon that creates income opportunities for people experiencing homelessness and poverty by producing a newspaper and other media that are catalysts for individual and social change. Today, the article we are discussing is called New Directions. Is he jumping from a sinking ship or bringing a much-needed lifeboat to Portland? I have with me Street Roots investigative reporter Henry Brennan, who wrote this article. Thanks for being here, Henry.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So this article is about the appointment of the new director of the Homeless Services Department, Nathaniel Vergao. So what's he walking into? And what might he be able to bring to the table is the main question that your article investigates. The Multnomah County Board of Commissioners hired him recently. So when will he start this position and how much money will he be making?
Yeah, those are good questions. Those are kind of the big ones. So he starts on May 4th and he'll be making $240,000 a year. So he's starting off pretty strong, I would say.
What exactly does the Homeless Service Department do and what is it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's basically Multnomah County's homelessness agency. So, you know, because of that, that means it basically does a ton of different things. So that's like making contracts with service providers, doing the yearly counts that let us know, you know, how many people are experiencing homelessness at one given day. Monitors kind of local spending of federal dollars, and then it funds a bunch of different things, whether it's like eviction prevention, shelters, street outreach, or like, you know, data collection. So yeah, it does a ton of different things.
So Vergao's being hired at kind of a tricky time for this department. Can you tell me about some of the challenges that the Homeless Service Department has been coming up against lately?
Yeah. I mean, for starters, they face, you know, an $87 million budget shortfall, which is, you know, a little more than a quarter of the current fiscal year's budget, which is about $334 million. So that's right off the bat, a pretty tough kind of way to start. But then in addition to that, there've been a wave of shelter closures and projected closures. There's been cuts to, you know, homeless service provider staff. And then to kind of top it all off, the county and the city are kind of engaged in this increasingly public battle over the best way to fight homelessness, where they're kind of taking different directions and also taking shots at each other very publicly.
What exactly does this position, the director of the Homeless Services Department, do?
Yeah, so I mean, he's basically stepping into that, you know, firestorm, and, you know, it's his job to run it. So they've hired him, you know, they've kind of highlighted a bunch of reasons, you know, mostly about his experience, but then they also highlighted his previous job, where he was senior Los Angeles's version of Los Angeles's version of HSD, where it's kind of a, although there it's a partnership between the county and the city of LA. But yeah, he's got a ton of experience running this type of stuff, and that's exactly what he's going to be doing here. Basically, just implementing policy and doing all sorts of all the admin stuff that goes with that job, being the director of the department.
So, before we get into the details of what exactly Nathaniel Vergao's qualifications are, what did the process of gathering this information and reporting this story look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, when the news first was released by the county early in April, the Oregonian, the Portland Mercury, and some others had some great stories about it that were super informative. And then, you know, last week my editor mentioned, you know, maybe we should put something out about that, really seeking to answer, you know, one, who is this guy? And then how's he going to lead? Because, you know, this is obviously, at any time, an extremely important job in the county, but especially right now, I would argue. We dug into his past, and you know, we reached out to his colleagues, people familiar with his employers, reporter who's covered him. And then I really did, you know, some deep internet sleuthing, you know. So I found like over 50 different pieces of kind of different types of online media that featured him. So that's mostly things like meeting minutes and agendas for things like county councils, city councils, even neighborhood commissions. I found news stories, grant applications, conference schedules, presentations, reports. And my personal favorite, he was included in the end notes of this kind of somewhat famous academic, Virginia Eubanks. She wrote this 2018 book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile Police and Punish the Poor, which apparently he was interviewed for. So we dove pretty deep on him, trying to see who he is.
Nathaniel Vergao has been working in homeless services in California for about 20 years, right? So how did he get his start in this work?
So I found that he graduated this college called Hamilton College back in 1995 with a BA in French literature or French language and literature. And you know, then there's some missing years. You know, I thought maybe he was in Boston. I couldn't really figure it out. But then in 2000, his LinkedIn shows that he's working as a social worker in San Francisco's Tenderloin neighborhood. And for people not familiar, that's kind of a poorer, more diverse neighborhood that has, you know, a lot of people living on the street, and a lot of history there too that isn't so negative, but gentrification has made it pretty negative, and especially around then. And so he's working as a social worker for a few years, and then he's promoted to program director there. Then around 2005, he takes a step away from his kind of career for about 5 or I guess about 6.5 years. And he basically works as a father to his three kids. That's his job. 2012, he steps back into the professional world, but just working in insurance. And then in 2014, he jumps back into social work. And from there, it's a pretty, you know, honestly, a pretty fast ascent. So late 2014, he ends up working as the outreach and assessment manager for this place, LA Family Housing. And I should say, I also talked to people who are familiar with his work there. And they basically described a guy who was very comfortable on the ground and had relationships with the people he served at some of these encampments, that some of them were pretty far out there. And I should say some news articles also reflect that. It's also, I guess, pretty relevant, the kind of the context of the time. You know, I went through that nonprofit's tax records, and it shows that he was working there at a time that their budget was growing. And also, you know, homelessness was growing. I also managed to talk to his old boss, the executive director. Her name's Stephanie Klasky Gamer, and she's been there, you know, 20 years or so. She's kind of a fixture of that area. And she had, you know, she was extremely nice. She had nothing but good stuff to say about him. And I do mean nothing, you know. Some of the quotes that she said were, he's an incredible systems thinker, a very kind human, always stays really grounded in mission and purpose, has a true sense of empathy for who we serve, and that plays out in how we deliver services to our participants. So, you know, no shortage of kind words. And I guess lastly on this note, she also said that, you know, some of the practices that they were working on there ended up, you know, he did a really good job spreading those kind of best practices around to other agencies, including where he would very shortly go on to work, the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority.
So that's kind of where he got his big break, right?
Yeah, so basically, you know, in late 2016, he gets hired as the direct, what was it? It was the director of homeless services at that, and I'm going to call it LHASA. That's kind of the abbreviation, LHASA. But this kind of hiring came at a time when, you know, there's just a huge, huge, huge explosion of money. You know, I found documents that showed that first year he joined, their budget was $132 million. And their budget, you know, the most recent one is $843 million. So just a huge inflow of cash. And basically the background on that is that, you know, for starters, homelessness was increasing. And they have a much, you know, more, there's just much more people experiencing homelessness there. It's a bigger city. But then kind of in addition to that, it was getting a lot of, you know, sensationalistic media coverage and media coverage just in general. And so voters there passed these two massive, one was a prop and one was a measure, but it left the region with just hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars a year to address this. And so that's really the time that he joins this organization in a pretty senior role, basically three levels, or four levels from the top. And so from there, that's when his online footprint really, really picks up. Like you start seeing him almost immediately in all of these meetings. Like, for instance, you know, within about a month of starting his job, maybe even a matter of weeks, he was presenting to this body called the West Side Regional Alliance of Councils, which is basically a bunch of different neighborhood groups. And you can see in meeting minutes, it says the point of him being there, or what he said while there, was Hughes explaining to them, quote, cheaper to provide housing and services than to keep people or persons on the street where they generate expensive healthcare and police activity slash costs. So he's basically explaining to people, like, you know, this is why we're spending all this money. Like, it's, you know, we're actually, this is the most cost-effective way to fight this stuff. And it also happens to be the most humane. And so he's really like in the weeds in this work. And you can really also see some of his beliefs starting to come out during this time. You know, I'd found conference presentations and other things before that, but I think a really telling piece of work from that era was in 2019, in kind of the summer. He did this presentation entitled Harm Reduction, Working with Active Substance Users. And so as a part of that, he's basically explaining his philosophy of, or well, it's not really his philosophy. He's explaining the philosophy of harm reduction, which is basically like providing people services and housing without requiring sobriety and these other kind of significant barriers. And so he's explaining this. And I think in what a lot of people would probably view as a pretty like humane and caring way. And it ends with these 10 takeaways. And I'm just going to read the last three because I think they're pretty telling of his views. Drug users deserve access to quality care, health, mental health, and housing. Drug users deserve help to be healthy as possible, and happy. And then finally, drug users can be housed successfully. And I think that really captures a lot of what he's trying to do, which is like implementing these policies and getting people housed. You know, around that time, he also authored a report to the LA City Council that I think was similarly telling, where it was basically on the, it was on like the best practices for how to handle people's things as they move from encampments onto the street. So again, he's like deep, deep, deep in these policies and trying to implement them in ways that I think you could view as more just or less traumatizing is kind of the read in that job.
When you say he was hired in 2016, the obvious next question is, what did he do when the pandemic hit? Because COVID affected the unhoused population, you know, hugely. How did Vergao handle COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right before COVID hits, for starters, he gets promoted to interim chief program officer, which, you know, if you're imagining the organization as a pyramid, there's the CEO at the top, and then there's two people below her. And he's one of those two people. The other is the chief financial officer, or basically more on the finance side. So he's basically in charge of all of their programming. So it's a huge position, and he's promoted to it on an interim basis. And then shortly after that happens, COVID hits. And so he's basically leading the agency's programming at the very beginning of COVID, which, you know, I'm sure many people remember was, you know, you know, certainly in my lifetime, unprecedented and you know, dramatic for people on the streets because there was higher rates of transmission, there was less access to healthcare, there was more pre-existing conditions, higher, I'm sure, mortality. It was, you know, a disaster, broadly speaking. And they're basically focusing on getting people in housing as quickly as possible, I'm told, in particular to avoid kind of this broad transmission. And people may remember Portland's Project Turnkey, but California was actually the first state to secure federal, I guess it would have been federal approval to house homeless people in motels. And so he's basically, and I should say, Lhasa is administering that. So he's, you know, basically in charge of that, you know, tremendously, tremendously important effort, as well as all the, you know, the million other things this agency is doing. So, you know, pretty significant experience. Then, you know, late 2020, obviously pandemic still very much raging. They hire somebody for that, that position he was in, that chief program officer. And he moves down one level to kind of that third tier where he's deputy chief program officer. So he's still basically in charge of implementing all of these policies. He just has kind of a boss above him. As well as that CEO. And so he's, you really see him in these meetings explaining the nuts and bolts of these policies, explaining, how different things are going, what they are, to just a pretty wide variety of different types of bodies. One example is, you see him explaining how Project Roomkey was kind of sunsetting or ending, where how they were doing it, getting people in different types of housing. And then you also kind of see them shifting to other modes of housing people as that kind of sunsetted. And I think one of the most telling ones in terms of the stuff he did was this use of, it was called the Encampment Resolution Funding. And it was put on by the state, but it's basically a way to get people out of homeless encampments and into housing. Obviously, LA, a lot like Portland, people do not want to see homeless people. And so there's, obviously a lot of momentum for that. And then, of course, people do want to house folks as well. And so I actually found documents on this grant that Lhasa had applied to, $14 million back in 2023. And so the project, it had set out in the application that I found, which he was the grant administrator on. So that's like the lead guy. House about 200 people living on this 4-mile stretch of freeway in LA over the next about 3 years. I was, I figure, let's see how that went. Did he succeed? And so I'm looking through annual reports, and I indeed find the 2025 annual report, and it shows that he, by the end of 2024, they pretty much, I mean, they basically dramatically exceeded. So they'd housed 210 people in interim housing, which already met their goal, but then they'd also housed another 236 in permanent housing, and they decided they're going to keep providing services to the people there. So that's things like substance use treatment, connecting them to that, but then also like helping people get documents like IDs and other things that are really key for getting housing. But obviously, if you're getting swept or just living on the street, those are hard to hold on to. And then in that same report, that annual report, there were other examples of really significant successes through that program too. In one on Skid Row, they reduced unsheltered homelessness in women by 47%. And I think there's a really telling quote at the end of that, which they talked about that, and they said that that quote gives us incredibly strong evidence that location-based and even subpopulation-focused interventions can overcome the rate of inflow into an encampment like Skid Row. So basically what they're saying is like, this approach that we're taking works. That's basically what they're saying. And then, as an aside, he also led a lot of other different programs. They were using a lot of rapid rehousing, which is basically like for people who, they're pretty able to function at a high level, but they get some kind of they hit some speed bumps in life and end up homeless. That's just like subsidizing an apartment for them at kind of a decreasing rate over a few years. And then another is tiny home villages that the county had kind of emphasized to me that he'd worked on. So he's profoundly in the weeds at this time, and quite successful, at least is what the documents I reviewed showed.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, obviously these projects are the result of, hundreds of people working together, but it is incredible to see how much that this person is supporting really successful projects that are helping people. I'm wondering if there are any like drawbacks or controversies, that you found in your reporting.
Yeah, absolutely. There was no shortage of that as well. And some of it, I found appeared to be, just kind of mundane workplace drama that he honestly seemed to come out pretty good of in terms of how he handled himself. But broadly speaking, the agency was really rocked by controversy at that period. They were hit with these audits in 2024 and 2025, and there's kind of these ongoing court cases against them. And I'll just read what the LA Times wrote about that second audit. It basically said that homeless services provided by Lhasa are, and here's where it becomes a quote, disjointed and lack adequate data systems and financial controls to monitor contracts for compliance and performance, leaving the system vulnerable to waste and fraud. So, obviously could be more brutal, but certainly, you know, not gentle. And those had pretty dramatic impacts. You know, really shortly after that came out, the LA County Board of Supervisors voted to pull resources from Lhasa, and they basically took about $300 million and 700 employees, which is, you know, just huge. I will say, you know, I heard mixed things about what really caused that. You know, some folks said that it was, you know, the agency was succeeding and that, you know, these types of problems are going to come when your budget goes up from, you know, 130 something million to 830 something million, or, you know, in the 100 millions to in the 800 millions. And that broadly they were successful. Other people, and I reached out to his critics and they didn't want to be interviewed, but you know, other people are like, you know, this is a mess. Obviously the LA County Board of Supervisors in the latter camps, they pull all this funding. You know, Vergao fights that in a hearing. You can see him basically be in, you know, in the hearing where this was eventually decided. You can see him quoted in the transcript as fighting this, basically saying like, you know, whatever works is good by me, but like, why are we rushing? We don't have a plan. How is this new agency going to do any better than what we had? You know, really centering the impacts of this stuff on people. You know, in the end, you know, their executive director resigns. A federal task force under the Trump administration, it's worth noting, announced to investigate the agency for fraud. So that's, you know, pretty much a disaster. But I will say, you know, his former boss, when I asked her, you know, what's a story that really captures who he is, she basically said that period and how he handled himself during that, basically saying that he stayed focused on his job and the people they serve. And then heaping, you know, more thoughtful praise on him after that. And, you know, during that time, and this is, you know, 2025 to now, he basically continues his work. So you still see him presenting the different things, LA's Commission on Disability, the Board of Supervisors. And then of course, I guess, you know, the last little bits before we get to where we are today is just, you know, recently Lhasa did miss a key deadline for the audit that they're going under, which risks their federal funding. And then about 2 days after that, the county announced that they'd selected him. So that kind of brings us to where we are now.
With all that time spent on this issue, what are some of your lasting impressions of Vergao from this report?
I mean, I think I don't definitively know by any means. You know, there were different strains that you could pick up on. You know, on one hand, he is jumping ship on, you know, this kind of sinking agency. On the other hand, you know, he's got a lot of experience that he's bringing to Portland. You know, to keep with that metaphor, you know, it's like a lifeboat. I think, you know, what I did really see in the reporting is his social worker background really seems to have shaped him. I suppose I don't know whether he's knowledgeable, but he's certainly deeply, deeply, deeply in the weeds on these very technical policies and programs and explaining them over the last decade. And struck people who I talked to, people I talked to talked to him, and he struck them as quite knowledgeable. And he basically just seemed to be focused on implementing a lot of policies at the time of... Or I guess basically just implementing these policies in a way that was maybe more humane or more effective for the people they serve. And of course, he did, you know, I did find him leading some very effective programs. You know, and obviously I still have a lot of questions as to, I'm sure everybody, but those were kind of some of the impressions I formed.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big question for me personally is, you know, looking at his accomplishments that there was documentation of, at least online, you know, they're significant. And, you know, I should also note LA has indeed, you know, it's a success story in that, you know, despite the county, you know, kind of going after Lhasa, they have succeeded in lowering the number of homeless people for 2 years in a row. But all the success It came at a time of just absolutely skyrocketing budgets. And so I think the big question is like, what can he do during this kind of era of budget cuts? And so, I think for me, that's kind of the big question. And I guess the last thing I would say is just, pick up a Street Roots this week. They're out on Wednesdays. And if you're curious where you can find a vendor, you can go to streetroots.org/vendors, another slash after that. And I think that's all I got.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time, Henry.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Street Roots investigative reporter Henry Brennan. For X-Ray FM, I'm Hannah Francis.